From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn what's in the nearly $1.5 billion proposed budget for Milwaukee Public Schools. Then we'll hear from the producer of a podcast that explores the impact of forever chemicals in Wisconsin.
PFAS is this big group of all kinds of chemicals. It's not just one pollutant. And so there are a lot of legal challenges to just determining basically who's responsible.
Plus, we'll learn about an invasive species that's threatening Wisconsin's trees called the spongy moth.
And it really got going here in the Midwest in about the 1980s or so. And so it's something that we've been watching now for quite a while, but it can cause some very significant damage in parts of the country where it is active.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Last month, voters narrowly approved a property tax hike for Milwaukee Public Schools. MPS leaders said the $252 million referendum was necessary to prevent major cuts to schools. Now, we do have a better idea of how MPS will use that referendum funding. Late last month, Superintendent Keith Posley released his $1.5 billion budget proposal for next school year. And even with the referendum, MPS is still facing cuts. WUWM editor Emily Files is here to go over some of those details. Hey, Emily.
Hey, Audrey. Thanks for having me.
So this MPS budget proposal is almost 1,000 pages long. So what were you able to glean from all of that information?
Right. The MPS budget is always a fun read. Lots of information there. I guess the first thing to mention is that MPS, when it was campaigning for this referendum that Milwaukee voters just approved, the leaders were saying that this is about sustaining the art, music, library, physical education positions that it's added in recent years. And the district was able to add those positions because of a previous referendum. But now it said it needed more funding to keep all of that going. And to illustrate the effects of the referendum and what MPS was trying to sustain here, it's gone from 50 music teachers in 2020 to over 100 this year. So no cuts to any of those positions in this budget, which is what MPS promised when it was advocating for the new referendum that was just passed.
Gotcha. So this referendum will allow MPS to keep those specialty music teachers, art, other positions. It's added in recent years, but we're still falling short, right?
Yeah. MPS is still facing a budget shortfall, and that's because the school district's revenue is down for a few reasons. One is state funding hasn't kept up with the skyrocketing inflation that we've seen in recent years. So MPS has had increased costs for teacher salaries and construction and all kinds of things. Also, student enrollment has declined. MPS saw a big hit to enrollment in 2021, 2022, those first pandemic years. And another big factor is MPS is losing, or the funding is ending that MPS received because of the pandemic. And this is special federal pandemic relief known as ESSER. MPS received hundreds of millions of dollars in ESSER funding. It was using that money to do renovations to schools, to build new sports facilities. And it also had to use some of that money to pay for staff. Now that that funding is coming to an end, MPS has to pull funding from other parts of the budget to cover those positions and services.
Right. So what kind of budget gap are we talking about here?
So MPS was forecasting a $200 million deficit. With the referendum, the district says the deficit has shrunk to $60 million. And that's because the referendum funding is being phased in to lessen the impact on property taxes. Instead of getting the full referendum amount in year one, MPS is getting an additional $140 million next year. So that doesn't cover the entire deficit it was expecting.
So what cost cutting is Superintendent Posley proposing in order to close that budget gap?
He's proposing downsizing by about 300 full-time positions, and with a workforce of about 10,000 people, that's an about 3% cut to MPS's staffing. One major part of that is that MPS is proposing to eliminate all school support teachers, and that's 130 positions. School support teachers are basically teacher mentors. They work in schools with the classroom teachers to improve instruction. MPS spokesperson Nicole Armendariz told me that MPS was previously receiving a grant to fund school support teachers, and when that grant went away, MPS started using the temporary pandemic funding, the ESSER funding I mentioned earlier, but that money, again, is running out, so MPS is eliminating the school support teachers, which will save the district about $12 million, or at least that's what's being proposed. But those school support teachers will have the option to be hired as classroom teachers for next school year, according to the district.
Wow, but still, cutting 130 school support teacher positions is significant. What other cuts is MPS making?
Yeah, so MPS has really said it's trying to keep the budget cuts away from students, away from classrooms. And so it's making most of the cuts in positions that aren't in the classroom teaching students directly. So it's cutting staff in technology, food service, curriculum, areas like that. And Posley is also proposing combining some departments to save money. For example, you may have heard of the Black and Latino Male Achievement Department, or BLMA. That department does targeted outreach to male students of color who have some of the worst educational outcomes in Milwaukee. And under this budget proposal, that department would be combined with a newer department that's focused on girls of color, and the staff in those departments would be reduced.
So you say that MPS is trying to keep the budget impacts away from students, but there still could be an impact on the student body, no matter what programs are cut or consolidated. So what do we think these cuts could mean for MPS students?
It's hard to say, but some of these departments or positions that are being affected, they do work directly with students and teachers, even if they aren't in a classroom delivering instruction every day. So it is possible that the programs and services students are getting would change.
We've talked about a number of things, but is there anything else in this budget that you think is worth pointing out?
So speaking of students and what this means for students, MPS has struggled, especially in the last few years during the pandemic, during the upheaval in the economy, MPS has struggled to fill a lot of positions, which has left students with substitute teachers or even virtual teachers to fill in the gaps. And MPS is again expecting to have a lot of vacant jobs. That's part of the budgeting process because it saves the district money. So MPS is expecting savings of $48 million from vacant positions in this budget. And critics have pointed to that and said, you know, instead of continuing to expect so many positions to go unfilled, MPS should look at its staffing plan and better align it with reality and cut some of those positions that it's not able to fill, put that money towards positions that it is.
When the referendum was being discussed, there was some question about whether MPS would need to just keep going back to taxpayers for more money. Like, what is the long-term solution for MPS's funding struggles? Does this budget shed any light on that?
Not really. The referendum didn't fix everything. MPS is still projecting deficits in future years, even though they'll be smaller with the referendum, especially once it gets fully phased in. So MPS will likely have to look at long-term cost-cutting options if it doesn't want to keep going back to referendum. The district is going to have a consultant study its facilities to plan for whether there should be school closures, to give advice on whether some school buildings are really underutilized, under-enrolled, and could be shuttered. So that facilities study is going to be happening this year and results later in the year from that, probably. So we'll see what kind of tough decisions MPS might have to make on that front.
Right. MPS has a total of 156 schools and less than 70,000 students, just to kind of give people a picture of what this consultant would be looking at. And when it comes to this budget isn't final yet, and there's a hearing on it tonight. So what happens next?
Right. So the MPS board starts with the superintendent's proposed budget, and then it holds public hearings to hear from the public. And board members will propose amendments. Maybe there are some cuts that they don't like that they want to change and cut in other areas. So those meetings with the school board are happening all throughout May. You can see more information about the budget or find instructions for testifying on the MPS website. And I'll also put links to that information on our website with this story at wuwm.com.
Great. Thanks so much, Emily.
Thanks, Audrey.
UW-Madison graduate Deborah Bloom is a nationally known writer. Her subject is poison. She's written two books on it and has a third in the works. Bloom taught science journalism and other courses at UW-Madison for about 18 years. She'll return this week to deliver the keynote remarks at graduation. Ahead of that, she joins WUWM's Chuck Kornbach to talk about her work.
I see poison as something that allows me to explore science in our everyday life, or chemistry in our everyday life. And because we live in a world which has a lot of toxic substances in it, some we're exposed to accidentally, some of us choose to use them in person, I use that subject to kind of explore both what you need to know about what's dangerous out there. Can I give you a toolkit to help you understand better the chemical world that we live in, and to make people comfortable with some of these questions about what's dangerous to them and what not, so that they can make what I think of as common sense decisions. Along the way, I like to tell stories about murder and other kind of fascinating aspects of behavior involving chemistry, but my main point really is education.
Are you at the bottom of the bottle, so to speak, in terms of writing about poison?
That's a great question. So I've written two books, The Poisoner's Handbook, which is about the invention of forensic toxicology, how do we catch a killer, and The Poison Squad, which is also chemistry in our everyday life, but more about food safety. How do we protect ourselves from dangerous elements that people may put deliberately or accidentally into food and drink? And I am now under contract to do my third book about poison in our everyday life, which is about murderers. I'm writing a book about female poisoners, who are the great under-recognized serial killers of history, and what they tell us about who we are.
Looking forward to it. You know, your side gig is Undark magazine. It's a science magazine that you helped launch. Tell us more about its name, if you will, and also its mission.
Sure. So Undark magazine was founded by me and its current editor, Tom Zeller, formerly of the New York Times, in 2016. And the name of Undark comes from a word I learned when working on The Poisoner's Handbook. Undark in the 1920s was the trade name for radium-based luminous paint. It was the paint that was used to make watch faces and dials glow in the dark. And it's actually a compound in which you mix radium atoms and zinc atoms, and the radium excites the zinc, and you get this greenish, bluish glow that we're all very familiar with lit dials. Back in the 20s, they would use that to light up clock faces, and they would hire young women to lip point those brushes when they were painting the numbers. And this led to a realization, actually, as these women got very sick because they were swallowing radium, that radioactive elements are dangerous. Radium was really the first case study in saying, look at this amazing advancement of science that is also really dangerous. And so when we started thinking about the magazine, we thought we want it to be about the push and pull between science and society. We wanted to illuminate the tensions and sometimes even the stresses that science brings to the world, the way science pushes us, the way we push back. And so we wanted a name that indicated that kind of complicated light that we were looking at science in, and we chose Undark. And we've really stayed true to that mission. is a magazine that does not do stories of beautiful snowflakes, say, but it will look at gender biases or race biases or, you know, malfeasance in science or environmental issues that we need to confront in a kind of complex human way.
There's an article in a current issue about the tough times for natural historians. Is that right? I know you didn't write that, but that's the type of article you're talking about.
That's exactly right. So we're looking at there where society really pushes back on questions of natural history. Can we maintain these collections? Why do we care? People who are not big fans of, say, in the idea of the theory of evolution are often very opposed to natural history collections as they trace the sort of evolution of species. And so it really explores some of those issues. It's a classic Undark story.
Well, despite the efforts of Undark and you and your books, there is some misinformation out there, incorrect information about science out there. What are a couple of glaring examples that come to mind?
So we definitely saw some of this during the COVID-19 pandemic. For instance, one of the great accomplishments during that pandemic was the creation of mRNA vaccines. And those vaccines very simply replicate one protein of the virus and use that as a target, right? They're very effective. They're very fast acting. You don't get anything but this single sort of protein from the virus to stimulate the immune system. People were spreading the idea that somehow, you know, that they were full viral loads, that they were altering your DNA, which makes no sense because there was no DNA going in with these vaccines. And you had a lot of people who were really afraid of these vaccines. At the most ridiculous, people were suggesting that they would somehow magnetize your body, right? Which obviously never happened. And so you saw this wash of misinformation about vaccines that are actually very good at saving lives. It was really frustrating because as a science journalist looking at these vaccines and understanding how they work and realizing how many lives that were unnecessarily lost because of the misinformation, just felt like a crisis in trying to push back against some of that bad information that was going out there. And it's frustrating to do that too. I mean, it's a complicated problem because of the internet. We can cherry pick our sources of information. So the very detailed explanation that I might put out there doesn't necessarily go to every person in the known universe. The very clear explanation we might put in Undark. I actually answered readers' questions about just these topics during the pandemic for Undark, right? So we were able to respond to those readers, but it wasn't as if everyone was hearing what they needed to hear. And as science journalists, because I think at heart, we really believe that a science literate public is important, that we make our best decisions by understanding these processes. It is a very frustrating time.
So what do we do? I mean, one thought I had was send all politicians and some of their staffers to a science university for a couple of years. But if we don't get that, what can we do?
Well, I can get on my soapbox about the way we should better teach science at the K-12 level. You know, our K-12 science education favors people who are going to become scientists by the time you get to high school. I actually had a scientist once describe it to me as a filtration system for the priesthood of science, right? If you're not destined for science, you know, you don't get sent to additional science classes. You don't really learn how the system works. I usually like to argue that especially in high school, we should have science classes that are just about science in our everyday life, right? The science of cooking might be a good example of that. Or I know some, my son's high school, when I was at UW-Madison, did a forensic science class in which they turned a classroom into a crime scene. These were all students who were never going to be scientists, but they learned about DNA analysis and blood analysis and toxicology and all the things you might learn while you were solving crimes. And they learned some familiarity with what I think of as the common sense of science. So I really would love to see us think, at least starting in the K-12 system, about how we educate Americans to better understand how science works. For science writers like me, you know, I think there's two things that I usually say to my community. One is, if you want to be a trusted source, get it right. One of the things that we do at the Knight Science Journalism Program is train people in fact-checking. Get it right going out the gate. Believe in the integrity of the story and make sure people understand that you care about that. I think that's part of what we do. I think another thing, and this goes against the rules of journalism to some extent, but we have a tendency in journalism to say, well, I've already told that story, right? Been there, done that, no need to repeat. Whereas the people who spread information repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat. So a lot of times when I'm talking to my fellow journalists, I say, you know, we should learn to value repetition, and it's on us to figure out different ways to tell a story, right? The kind of, you know, mRNA vaccine story that I just mentioned, for instance, how many ways can I tell the story that gets them information out there? The story of a sick person, the story of a researcher, the story of a hospital, the story of a crusader. There's a lot of ways that we can come back to the same information and bring it around in new and fresh ways. And I think it's on us not to just say, well, I already did that, but to say I'm in this, right, to try and try and try again to get good information out there.
Yeah, it's putting some new paragraphs in at the top, and then at paragraph 7 or 8 or 9, you can remind folks what this is all about and where it started and so on. That's sort of one method.
That's right. And the other thing that I do, and I think of, I'm a narrative journalist, right? I think of narrative journalists as kind of a subversive education, but I will tell you the story of a really good murder, right? This is one of my favorite ways to get at this. And in woven into the story of that murder, say it's someone who dies of carbon monoxide poisonings. You know, what is carbon monoxide? How does it kill you? How do you recognize even a carbon monoxide corpse? I actually have a PowerPoint in which I walk people through solving a carbon monoxide murder. And my thought is, I'm not going to lecture you about carbon monoxide. I'm just going to tell you a really good story. And embedded in that is some interesting science. So I think another thing we can do as writers and storytellers in particular is just remember that we can tell a really good story. We don't have to be heavy-handed about getting information out there and build some really fascinating science in there. And I've learned doing this not to underestimate the American public. A lot of people know a surprising amount about science. It's just a matter of building on that knowledge in interesting ways.
Girl, I must warn you. Deborah Bloom is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and director of the Knight Science Journalism Program at MIT. She spoke with WUWM's Chuck Hornbach. An invasive species known as the spongy moth is threatening Wisconsin trees. We'll learn about them and ways to prevent defoliation in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll look at how Wisconsin is responding to forever chemicals called PFAS. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Recently, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency set the first standard for PFAS in drinking water, also known as the man-made forever chemicals found in everyday products like clothing and cookware. But those new limits are well below Wisconsin's current regulations. A podcast called Public Trust explores Wisconsin's response to PFAS contamination from the perspective of residents across the state who have been directly impacted. The podcast was produced by the nonprofit Midwestern Environmental Advocates and the Wisconsin Sea Grant. Rochelle Wilson hosted and co-produced the series. She joins WUWM's Lena Tran to talk about the project.
How did this project get started?
I was a graduate student at UW-Madison in the Center for the Humanities, and I'd received a research fellowship. And for these fellowships, they place research fellows with community organizations that are doing good work. And so in Madison, I was placed with Midwest Environmental Advocates. They're a nonprofit environmental law firm that is in Madison, but they do work all around the state of Wisconsin and helping communities, especially at the grassroots level, to fight environmental injustices. So when I was brought on with them, they knew that I was a media professional, and they were like, ooh, time to make a podcast. So that was really exciting for them. And we did a lot of talking about what that might look like, what kind of topic we might cover. And PFAS just kept resurfacing as this really important thing going on in the state. A lot of communities dealing with PFAS contamination, but a lot of people not necessarily knowing exactly what it is or how it's affecting folks here in the state. So we partnered up with Wisconsin Sea Grant. They are, you know, they do work on PFAS as well, and they helped with production support. And from there, we just kind of took it to the communities that, you know, we knew were suffering PFAS contamination in Peshtigo in northern Wisconsin and also French Island in western Wisconsin on the Mississippi.
So you just mentioned the towns that you visited over the course of your reporting. There are so many different sources of PFAS. Can you paint a picture of what sources were most relevant to the communities that you visited?
Right. So we haven't quite said this in the conversation yet, but, you know, PFAS, you may have also heard them be called forever chemicals. And that's basically because once they're in the environment, they don't break down easily, or in the human body for that matter. So, you know, this is a serious problem, and there's tons of sources of PFAS. It's a class of chemicals, and there are thousands of different kinds of PFAS. There's PFOA, there's PFOS, some of those you might have heard of in the news. And essentially, these are man-made chemicals that go into plastics, like a lot of plastic-based products. You might find them in a lot of waterproof things like boots, raincoats, you know, makeup, food wrappers. There's just all kinds of stuff. On the industrial scale, though, a lot of the PFAS that we're finding in Wisconsin is coming from firefighting foam. So that's basically foam that they're using, especially at airports, to fight fires there. And you're just spraying that foam all over, and it's going to be seeping into the ground. So that those were the main sources of PFAS that were, you know, contaminating wells in Peshtigo and on French Island. It was this firefighting foam, and that was the big culprit.
Right. And can you bring people up to speed on the landscape of PFAS regulation? Like, what standards are there and are there not in the state?
Yeah, I mean, that is probably the main thing that I was trying to puzzle through this entire time. And fortunately, working with Midwest Environmental Advocates, they're environmental lawyers, they know their stuff. But I think even they would tell you this is a pretty regulatory kind of patchwork, state by state. There's not a lot of federal regulations about this, or at least there weren't until more recently. So the way that it works in Wisconsin, well, and I guess the way that it works everywhere, there's sort of three kind of ways to regulate PFAS in water sources. So there's surface water, and that's essentially your lakes, your rivers, and things like that. And there are regulations for those in the state. You know, it's so many parts per trillion that can be found. There is also municipal water, which is essentially, and this is funny enough, we discovered this while making the podcast. It's called drinking water. So drinking water standards, when they say that, they're referring to municipal water systems. So that's essentially like a system that serves, you know, a city or a neighborhood, a utility. And that has regulations on it as well. Then the third one is groundwater. And that's essentially just, you know, the water from the ground that is going to be filtering into private wells. There's a lot of Wisconsinites who are getting their water from private wells. I think the estimate is about 2/3. So that has no regulations on it. And that's been kind of an ongoing debate when it comes to like the DNR about, you know, regulating PFAS in groundwater. But we haven't seen that move forward in Wisconsin just yet.
Yeah. And then, of course, the EPA just passed these new standards, which you alluded to, which are much lower than the state's drinking water standards.
That's right. So, you know, we are going to have to come into compliance. And I think there's going to be, you know, all of these like federal challenges potentially to that new regulation. It's not going to go into effect for a couple years. So, you know, municipalities will have time to figure out exactly how they're going to implement this and get up to the federal standard. But there's like a lot to play out between now and then. So, you know, we're just kind of keeping our eyes peeled.
Yeah. Something that struck me about this is how personal PFAS contamination is. You know, the people that you spoke to feel that their lives have been intruded by this contaminant in very real ways. And you hear that echo throughout all these conversations. What did you learn about talking to people through that kind of grief or sense of loss?
Yeah, that immediately makes me think of one of the interviewees we spoke with in Peshtigo, Trigvi Rude. He appears in the podcast. He's a retired soil scientist, and he had been working for over 30 years to help delist the Menominee River as an area of concern. And that had been contaminated with arsenic salts. And, you know, he had worked tirelessly to try and help with that river cleanup and getting things going. The way that he tells it, just weeks after that had been resolved and the Menominee River was delisted, he received a letter from Tyco, which is, you know, a major company, saying, hey, you have PFAS contamination in your water supply. And he thought, here we go again. You know, he had just like, fought this major fight. His home being like burgled.
It's kind of a different feeling I've ever had. You hear people talk about their house being burgled or something to that nature, and how they talk about it being so personal. And I think that's the same feeling. It's something that hits you directly.
To know that you have been drinking water contaminated with PFAS, that it's running through your pipes into your house, that was a really personal feeling for not only him, but pretty much everyone we talked to.
Yeah. And the amazing thing is that that has really mobilized so many of the people that you talk to towards political action or, you know, advocacy. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you observed?
Yeah. So staying in Peshtigo for just a minute, Trigvi, who I just mentioned, and his neighbors kind of like banded together to be like, you know, what's going on here and how can we help? And I mentioned earlier the patchwork of regulations. A lot of times with PFAS remediation, you can also have this patchwork of like this mapping of like, okay, these houses are in the contaminated zone and like these other houses, like maybe even one right across the street, are not. And we were talking with folks and they were like, well, water doesn't understand these geographical boundaries that we're drawing. So there's a really good chance that our neighbors have PFAS as well. And they're not necessarily being included on that map to get help from the DNR or to, you know, reach a settlement with Tyco or whatever the solution may be. So there was all this like individual household management of what are we going to do about our PFAS problem as a household. And, you know, the folks in Peshtigo, they wanted to band together, some of them, the folks we talked to, and say, this is a community problem. This is, you know, this goes beyond just household to household. We want to see regulations in place. We want to see a sustainable solution that helps all of our neighbors for generations to come. So I think that that really did politically mobilize them there. And we saw a really similar thing go on over in French Island where we visited. They've been drinking bottled water for 3 years because of the tap water being contaminated with PFAS. And they also are looking for those community solutions and not just individual house by house.
So you worked on this project while you were a fellow at MEA. Can you talk about the solutions that MEA is calling for?
Yeah, well, so at Midwest Environmental Advocates, you know, they're lawyers. And so they're seeking legal solutions and really to have like strong regulations here in the state to protect people, you know, when it comes to something like PFAS contamination. They want to hold polluters accountable, and they're especially invested in, you know, making sure that the spills law remains strong. And that is a law here on the books in Wisconsin that, you know, basically holds polluters accountable to remediation and cleanup when they've been the source of pollution contamination. there's a bunch of legal challenges to the spills law in the state, and especially as it relates to PFAS, because as I mentioned before, PFAS is this big group of all kinds of chemicals. It's not just one pollutant. And so there are a lot of legal challenges to just determining, you know, basically who's responsible when PFAS contamination is found in a community. So MEA is seeking to really bolster the spills law, enforce that, and also looking to see those groundwater standards for PFAS at the state level. We're looking for those to be established so that when it's your private well that has been contaminated with PFAS, there are options for you.
Yeah. How did working on this project and doing all this reporting, did it change your perspective on water at all?
I have to say, I kind of vacillated doing this project between being a little bit, you know, anxious and even fixated on PFAS, like, wow, it's everywhere. And it really is. Like, it's all over our environment. There's research showing that, like, a lot of people already have, you know, PFAS, some amount of it in their bloodstream, in their bodies. And, you know, here in Madison, surrounded by water, it's just like, it kind of feels like a horror movie where, you know, it's everywhere. So there was this part of me that was like, oh my gosh, you know, I need to get rid of all my nonstick cookware and I need to, you know, kind of comb through my house and like find all these things that might have PFAS and really kind of get it out of my life. And then there were other times when I just like kind of felt like I couldn't be bothered. Like that's too exhausting, you know? And I think that that is a common feeling that a lot of people have is, you know, they're nervous and anxious about it and they want to do absolutely everything they can. But at the end of the day, you also have to live your life. And, you know, PFAS is something that, you know, many of the people we talk to feel like this should be something that corporations and governments are taking care of and not left to the individual to kind of anxiously try and remove PFAS from their home. I also have to say that I really valued being able to drink my tap water. You'll hear in the first episode, it's, you know, me filling up that cup. I do it every morning and I drink from the tap. And that's an act of trust in local government.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Rochelle, for coming on to Lake Effect and talking more about public trust.
Thanks for having me.
Michelle Wilson is the host and producer of the podcast Public Trust, which explores PFAS in Wisconsin. She spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why Wisconsin is so important in this election year. The first episode is available now, and you can find it wherever you listen to your podcasts. The next episode drops tomorrow. Coming up next, we'll learn about spongy moths and how this invasive species could impact Wisconsin's trees. That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Hardwood trees in Wisconsin, such as birch, maple, and oak, are in danger of defoliation. An invasive species of moth, whose caterpillars are known for eating up leaves, could be especially prevalent in Wisconsin this summer. Last year, we saw a record outbreak of the spongy moth in Wisconsin, and scientists warn this year could be just as bad. P.J. Leash is an extension entomologist and director of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. He spoke with Mallory Chang in 2022 when the spongy moth first made a resurgence in the state.
What exactly is the spongy moth? Where did they come from? Should this be of concern?
To hit on your last part first, this is an insect of concern. And what the spongy moth is, it's a type of caterpillar that is originally native to parts of Europe. And there's a long story behind it, but it's been in the US well over 100 years, about 150-ish years at this point. And the reason it's a concern is the larvae or caterpillar stage can feed on a wide range of hardwood trees. And in particular, they're very fond of oaks. And have had lots of reports of tree damage, including defoliation, due to these insects. The caterpillars can can get to be pretty large, up to about 2.5 inches long. When they are larger and more mature, they have kind of a dark grayish color, but they have these very distinctive bumps or nodules and pairs running down the middle of their back. And these are very distinctive reddish and bluish color. They'll have a series of red ones and a series of blue ones. So pretty easy to identify.
How did it get to Southeast Wisconsin?
So the trip to Southeast Wisconsin, Wisconsin in general, is a long story. What's interesting with this insect is we know pretty much exactly where and when it was brought in and also who brought it in. There was a scientist living in Massachusetts, and he had the idea of starting an American silkworm industry like we have in other parts of the globe. And he had the idea of hybridizing some of our native North American silk moths with a hardy European species, this spongy moth. And so he imported some of these. He had them in his house. They escaped from his house. And then after a while, it started causing some significant defoliation in parts of Massachusetts. It spread outwards from there. And this was a slow process, but you can actually look back in history books and see it progress through the 1800s, through the 1900s. And then it really got going here in the Midwest in about the 1980s or so. So it's been about 30, 40 or so years for us. And so it's something that we've been watching now for quite a while, but it can cause some very significant damage in parts of the country where it is active.
So the spongy moths have been here since the 1980s. And how is the spongy moth different from previous years that it's been in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so one thing that stands out is the number of reports I've been getting. And with any insect species, there can be ups and downs. And we know that with the spongy moth, we can see these kind of cyclical patterns. Some years we get outbreaks, sometimes their populations are very low. And I think if we look back at 2021, that actually set the stage for the story that's unfolding here. It turns out that there was a beneficial fungus that was introduced a while back, and it specifically can kill off this invasive spongy moth, the caterpillar stage. So that really helps us out. And it turns out that the fungus is encouraged during rainy years. And intuitively, that makes sense. Damp conditions will favor fungal growth, that sort of thing. Well, if we think back to 2021, we had very dry, droughty conditions in many parts of Wisconsin, including the southeast corner of the state, was hit very hard by the drought. So with the dry conditions, that suppressed the fungus. It allowed the spongy moth populations to climb upwards. And so when the egg masses are laid, we knew that kind of set the stage, because every egg mass can contain upwards of maybe 1,000 or so eggs. And again, it was the dry condition that likely helped increase the numbers and cause some of the problems we're seeing.
And what will generally happen in the long run in our forest areas if the spongy moths aren't really dealt with?
It's always hard to predict the future in terms of what will be in store for forested areas, but also urban areas, yard trees, street trees, for example. Now, one thing to keep in mind, and this is an important point, because I've seen a lot of posts online on social media and Nextdoor app and things that folks being really worried about their trees this year. And I like to remind folks that if you have a tree, such as an oak tree, that is in otherwise good health, it can withstand complete defoliation. They have energy reserves. Those trees can put out another batch of leaves and will leaf out again. If this happens once, that's one thing. If it happens repeatedly, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, then I start to get nervous about those trees because we may have secondary problems pop up. So for larger forested areas, there's not a whole lot that we can really do in cases like that other than let things run their course. But some good news is with that introduced beneficial fungus, Entomophaga myemiga, I mentioned earlier, if we have a year with average or above average rainfall and precipitation, that tends to help us out, and that can actually cause their populations to crash. The caterpillars can just become sick with it and die. So what I am hopeful for is many parts of the state so far have had pretty good amounts of rain. I'm hoping that that will kick in and encourage that beneficial fungus, and that may help bring their populations under control. So we're always going to have some ups and downs, but if we get good rainfall, that helps us out in the long run.
That's really good to know. Should individuals act on preventing spongy moths from spreading? Should we take it upon ourselves to, deal with them, or should we leave that generally up to the experts?
I think it really boils down to the scope of an individual situation. So if you are looking at, say, the trees in your yard, maybe you have some large, old, high-value oak trees, for example, and it definitely can be worth it to intervene and do something about it, especially if you have lots and lots of spongy moth caterpillars and they're causing a lot of damage. So there are some tactics. If you've ever driven by and seen a tree where there is some burlap tied around the trunk, that's actually a way we can deal with these, because the caterpillars like to hide during the day and they'll climb up into the canopy and feed at night. And so we can use some burlap bands. The caterpillars come down, they hide. We can then go out there, brush them into a container of soapy water. You'd have to do that daily, but that's something you could do. You could also consider contacting arborists. You have to look at different scales, though. If we are talking about larger forested areas, there isn't really anything that an individual person can do for that. Some groups within the state, Department of Ag, for example, does do some aerial spraying to limit and slow down the westward spread of this insect. The idea is we're looking at the national picture and trying to slow it down from getting to places like Minnesota. So there's some efforts like that. One very simple thing that anyone can do, though, to really help limit and minimize the spread would be to try your best to not transport this insect, especially in the egg stage. The egg masses can be up to about 2 or so inches long, beige. They have a very velvety, soft appearance and kind of spongy to the touch, hence the name a spongy moth. And sometimes those egg masses could be on undersides of vehicles, firewood and things like that. We do actually have a firewood quarantine in the state. And so we don't want to take firewood from an area like Southeast Wisconsin and transport it to Western Wisconsin or Minnesota. Because if we do that, there's definitely a chance that we could be moving this insect around. And again, if we move eggs, it's not just one insect. That's potentially a population of 1,000 or so. So that's one simple thing, is not move firewood and other materials around that might be harboring this insect.
Thank you so much, PJ, for being here on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you being here.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me today.
PJ Leash is an extension entomologist and director of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. He spoke with former Lake Effect producer Mallory Chang in 2022. If you visit Milwaukee's downtown a lot, you may have noticed one of our landmarks is missing. The ladybugs have left their landing on the side of the Ladybug Building on Water Street. WUWM's Nadia Kelly is looking into the disappearance, but for now, here's a part of a bubbler talk that WUWM's Rachel Owens did on the ladybugs back in 2017.
All the years I've lived in Milwaukee and driven north on water, just south of Wisconsin, there's a building on the east side that has ladybugs, and I've wondered why the ladybugs are there.
They're hard to miss, crawling down the west side of the Milwaukee building at 622 North Water Street. The key to understanding the bugs, though, is knowing the mastermind behind them, John J. Burke, founder of Burke Properties, which owns and manages the building. The company is now run by his daughter, Wendy Burke. She explains how the bugs landed there.
They've been hanging there since about July of 1999. My father had a sign maker who he had worked with in a prior business venture make those ladybugs for them. They're about 6 feet tall and about 3 feet deep.
And that's just as John Burke designed them. The ladybugs were his brainchild and built to his exact specifications, right down to the paint job. Made of fiberglass, they're durable, yet light enough for a 3-person crew to install. And Wendy Burke should know she was on that crew.
Early one morning in July, he had a friend on a cherry picker down in the street. We were hoisting those things up from an open window on the 6th floor and then securing them to the building. It was a do-it-yourselfer.
John Burke even decided where the bugs should land on the building, adjusting them on the fly until he felt he had them just right. But why put them there in the first place?
At the time, in the city, there was some conversation going on about what is decoration and what is art. There were some artists who were very much opposed and were very verbal about how much they did not like the ladybugs. And my father was adamant that art is in the eye of the beholder, and he just thought they were cool.
The ladybugs aren't the only art on or in the Milwaukee building either. Take the elevator up to the 2nd floor and you walk into a modern art gallery, which also houses the offices of Burke Properties. One of the most stunning pieces, by world-renowned Milwaukee artist Mark Sijin, is a lifelike sculpture of a young woman kneeling with her eyes closed, titled Meditation. Still, the ladybugs loom large, literally. The lowest of the three hangs just outside the office where John Burke used to work. It's not hard to imagine him enjoying his unique view from his desk of the inside of the bug. But what did he think about how they appear to most of us from the outside? Wendy Burke recalls his reaction when he first saw his completed creation.
There was a restaurant called Mannequins across the street in the floor of the Chase Tower, and he was sort of like Christo, sitting back and admiring his handiwork. And I think probably that same day, Mayor Norquist walked by and said, "Hey, John, like the bugs." So he was very pleased with his art, his public art.
That was a part of a Bubbler Talk that WUWM's Rachel Owens did in 2017. Stay tuned for more from WUWM to learn where the ladybugs have flown off to. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, Milwaukee's fire chief explains how the department is addressing mental health concerns among firefighters. Plus, we'll learn how one Milwaukee bar celebrated Cinco de Mayo this past weekend with a long-standing tradition. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.